The shield barged into his chest and knocked his breath out, pressed him back. He tried to dodge away, but he lurched on his weak leg, and the short sword darted out and caught him across the arm.
"Gah!"
squawked Logan, staggering against a stone, drops of blood pattering from the cut into the grass.
"One to me!"
chuckled Phineas, dancing sideways and waving his sword around. Logan stood and watched him, breathing hard. The shield was a big one, and this smiling bastard used it well. Gave him quite the advantage. He was quick, no doubt. Quicker than Logan now, with a bad leg, a cut arm, and a thick head from a punch in the mouth. Where was the bloody nine when you wanted him? Logan spat on the ground. This fight he'd have to win alone. He edged back, stooping more and panting harder than he needed to, letting his arm dangle as if it was useless, blood dripping from his limp fingers, blinking and wincing. He edged back past the stones into a space with more room, a nice wide space where he could get a decent swing. Phineas followed him, shield held up in front.
"That it?" he grinned as he came on. "Already fading, eh? I can't say I'm not disappointed. I was hoping for a..."
Logan roared, springing suddenly forward and lifting the Maker's sword above his head in both hands. Phineas scrambled back, but not quite far enough. The grey blade tore a chunk from the corner of his shield, sliced clean through, and chopped deep into the side of one of the stones with a mighty clang, sending chips of rock spinning. The impact nearly tore the sword from Logan's hands, sent him flailing sideways. Phineas groaned. Blood was running from a cut on his shoulder, a cut right through his leather armor and into the flesh. The tip of the sword must have gashed him as it passed. Not deep enough to kill, unfortunately, but deep enough to make the point all right. It was Logan's turn to grin.
"That it?"
They moved at the same moment. The two blades clanged together, but Logan's grip was the stronger. Phineas's sword twittered as it spun from his hand and away down the hillside. He gasped, snatching at his belt for a dagger, but before he could get there, Logan was on him, growling and grunting as he chopped mindlessly away at the shield, hacking great scars in the wood and sending splinters flying, driving Phineas stumbling away. One last blow crashed into the shield, and he staggered from the force of it, tripped over the corner of a fallen stone poking through the grass, and tumbled onto his back. Logan gritted his teeth and swung the Maker's sword down. It sliced clean through the greave on Phineas's shin and took his foot off just above the ankle, splattering blood into the grass. He dragged himself backwards, started to scramble up, shrieked as he tried to put his weight on his missing foot, dropped onto the stump, and sprawled on his back again, coughing and groaning.
"My foot!"
he wailed.
"Put it out of your mind,"
growled Logan, kicking the dead thing out of his way and stepping forward.
"Wait!"
gurgled Phineas, shoving himself back through the grass with his good leg towards one of the standing stones, leaving a bloody trail behind him.
"For what?" "Just wait!"
He dragged himself up the rock, hopped on his remaining foot, cringing away.
"Wait!"
he screamed. Logan's sword caught the inside rim of the shield, tore the straps away from Phineas's limp arm, and flung it bouncing down the slope on its chewed-up edge. Phineas gave a desperate wail and pulled out his knife, poised himself on his one good leg to lunge. Logan chopped a great gash in his chest. Blood sprayed out and showered down his breastplate. His eyes bulged, he opened his mouth wide, but all that came out was a gentle wheeze. The dagger dropped from his fingers and fell silently into the grass. He slid sideways and dropped onto his face. Back to the mud with that. Logan stood and blinked and breathed. The cut on his arm was starting to sting like fire. His leg was aching. His breath was coming in ragged gasps.
"Still alive,"
he muttered to himself.
"Still alive."
He closed his eyes for a moment.
"Shit,"
he gasped. "The others." He started to hobble back up the slope towards the summit. The arrow in her shoulder had made her slow. Her shirt was wet with blood, and she was getting thirsty and stiff and sluggish. He slid out from behind one of the stones, and before she knew it, he was on her. There was no room to use the sword any longer, so she let it drop. She made a grab for her knife, but he caught her by the wrist, and he was strong. He threw her back against the stone, and her head cracked against it, made her dizzy for a moment. She could see a muscle trembling under his eye, the black pores on his nose, the fibers standing out on his neck. She twisted and struggled, but his weight bore down on her. She snarled and spat, but even Pharaoh's strength was not endless. Her arms trembled, her elbows bent. His hand found her throat and tightened round it. He muttered something through clenched teeth, squeezing and squeezing. She could not breathe any longer, and the strength was ebbing out of her. Then, through her half-closed eyes, she saw a hand slither round his face from behind, a big, pale, three-fingered hand caked with dry blood. A big, pale forearm followed it, and another from the other side folding his head tightly. He wriggled and struggled, but there was no escape. The thick sinews flexed and squirmed under the skin, and the pale fingers dug into his face, dragging his head back and to the side further and further. He let go of Pharaoh, and she sagged against the stone, sucking in air. He scrabbled uselessly at the arms with his fingernails. He made a long, strange hissing sound as his head was twisted relentlessly round. Crunch. The arms let go, and he crumpled on the floor, head hanging. Nine Fingers stood behind. There was dry blood across his face, blood on his hands, blood soaked through his torn clothes. His face was pale and twitchy, streaked with dirt and sweat.
You all right?
About like you, she croaked.
Any left?
He put one hand on the stone beside her and leaned over, spat blood out onto the grass.
Dunno. Couple, maybe.
She squinted up at the summit of the hill.
Up there?
Could be.
She bent and snatched the curved sword up from the grass, started to limp up the slope, using it like a crutch. She heard Nine Fingers struggling after her. For some minutes now, Giselle had heard occasional shouting, screaming, and clashing of metal on metal. Everything was vague and distant, filtering to his ears through the blustering wind across the hilltop. He had no clue what was happening beyond the circle of stones at the hill's summit, and he was not sure he wanted to know. He strode up and down, his hands opening and closing, and all the while Quai sat on the cart, looking down at Baez, silent and infuriatingly calm. It was then that he saw it. A man's head, rising up over the brow of the hill between two tall stones. Next came his shoulders, then his chest. Another appeared not far away. A second man. Two killers advancing up the slope towards him. One of them had piggy eyes and a heavy jaw. The other was thinner, with a tangled thatch of fair hair. They moved cautiously up onto the summit of the hill until they stood within the circle of stones, examining Giselle and Quai and the cart with no particular urgency. Giselle had never fought two men at once before. He had never fought to the death before either, but he tried not to think about that. This was simply a fencing match, nothing new. He swallowed and drew his steels. The metal rang reassuringly as it slid out. The familiar weight in his palms was a small comfort. The two men stared at him, and Giselle stared back, trying to remember what Nine Fingers had told him. Try to look weak. That at least did not present much difficulty. He did not doubt that he appeared suitably scared. It was the most he could do not to turn and run. He backed slowly away towards the cart, licking his lips with a nervousness that was anything but feigned. Never take an enemy lightly. He looked them over, these two. Strong-looking men, well-equipped. They both wore armor of rigid leather, carried square shields. One had a short sword, the other an axe with a heavy blade. Deadly-looking weapons, well-worn. Taking them lightly was hardly his problem. They spread out, moving round to either side of him, and he watched them go. The time comes to act, you strike with no backward glances. The one on Giselle's left came at him. He saw the man snarl, saw him rear up, saw the great unwieldy backswing. It was an absurdly simple matter for him to step out of the way and let it thud into the turf beside him. On an instinct, he thrust with his short steel and buried it in the man's side up to the hilt, between his breastplate and his backplate, just under his bottom rib. Even as Giselle was ripping the blade back, he was ducking under the other's axe and whipping his long steel across at neck height. He danced past them and spun around, steels held ready, waiting for the referee's call. The one he had stabbed staggered a step or two, wheezing and grabbing at his side. The other stood there, swaying, his piggy eyes bulging, his hand clutched to his neck. Blood began to pour out between his fingers from his slit throat. They fell almost at the same time, face down, right next to each other. Giselle frowned at the blood on his long steel. He frowned at the two corpses he had made. Almost without thinking, he had killed two men. He should have felt guilty, but he felt numb. No, he felt proud. He felt exhilarated. He looked up at Kwai, watching him calmly from the back of the cart. "I did it," he muttered, and the apprentice nodded slowly. "I did it!" he shouted, waving his bloody short steel in the air. Kwai frowned, and then his eyes went wide. "Behind you!" he shouted, half jumping out of his seat. Giselle turned, bringing up his steels, saw something moving out of the very corner of his eye. There was a mighty crunching, and his head exploded with brilliant light. Then all was darkness. Chapter 23 The Fruits of Boldness. The Northmen stood on the hill, a thin row of dark figures with the white sky behind them. It was still early, and the sun was nothing more than a bright smear among thick clouds. Patches of half-melted snow were scattered cold and dirty in the hollows of the valley sides. A thin layer of mist was still clinging to the valley floor. West watched that row of black shapes and frowned. He did not like the flavor of this. Too many for a scouting or a foraging party, far too few to mount any challenge, and yet they stayed there on the high ground, watching calmly as Ladislaw's army continued its interminable, clumsy deployment in the valley beneath them. The prince's staff and a small detachment of his guards had made their headquarters on a grassy knoll opposite the Northmen's hill. It had seemed a fine dry spot when the scouts found it early that morning, well below the enemy perhaps, but still high enough to get a good view of the valley. Since then, the passage of thousands of sliding boots, squashing hooves, and churning cartwheels had ground the wet earth to sticky black muck. West's own boots, and those of the other men around, were caked with it, their uniforms spattered with it. Even Prince Ladislaw's pristine whites had acquired a few smears. A couple of hundred strides ahead on lower ground was the center of the Union battle line. Four battalions of the King's Own Infantry formed the backbone, each one a neat block of bright red cloth and dull steel, looking at this distance as though they had been positioned with a giant ruler. In front of them were a few thin ranks of flat bowmen in their leather jerkins and steel caps. Behind were the cavalry, dismounted for the time being, the riders looking strangely ungainly in full armor. Spread out to either side were the haphazard shapes of the levy battalions, with their assortment of mismatched equipment, their officers bellowing and waving their arms, trying to get the gaps to close up, the skewed ranks to straighten, like sheepdogs barking at a flock of wayward sheep. 10,000 men, perhaps, all told. Every one of them, West knew, was looking up at that thin screen of Northmen. No doubt with the same nervous mixture of fear and excitement, curiosity and anger that he was feeling at his first sight of the enemy. They hardly seemed too fearsome through his eyeglass. Shaggy-headed men, dressed in ragged hides and furs, gripping primitive-looking weapons. Just what the least imaginative members of the prince's staff might have been expecting. They scarcely looked like any part of the army that Three Trees had described, and West did not like that. There was no way of knowing what was on the far side of that hill, no reason for those men to be there but to distract them or draw them on. Not everyone shared his doubts, however.
"They mock us," snapped Smund, squinting up through his own eyeglass. "We should give them a taste of Union lances. A swift charge, and our horsemen will sweep that rabble aside and carry that hill."
He spoke almost as if the carrying of that hill, irrelevant except for the fact that the Northmen were standing on it, would bring the campaign to a swift and glorious conclusion. West could do nothing but grit his teeth and shake his head, as he had done 100 times already today. "They have the high ground," he explained, taking care to speak slowly and patiently. "Poor terrain for a charge, and they may have support. Bethod's main body, for all we know, just over the rise."
"They look like nothing more than scouts," muttered Ladislaw.
"Looks can lie, Your Highness, and that hill is worthless. Time is with us. Marshal Burr will be marching to our aid, while Bethod can expect no help. We have no reason to seek a battle now."
Smund snorted.
"No reason, except that this is a war, and the enemy stand before us on Union soil. You're always carping on the poor state of the men's morale, Colonel." He jabbed his finger up at the hill. "What could be more damaging to their spirits than to sit idle in the face of the enemy?"
"A sharp and purposeless defeat," growled West.
It was an unfortunate chance that one of the Northmen chose that moment to loose an arrow down into the valley. A tiny black sliver sailed up into the sky. It came only from a short bow. Even with the advantage of height, the shaft plopped down harmlessly into open ground 100 strides or more from the front lines. A singularly pointless gesture, but its effect on Prince Ladislaw was immediate. He abandoned his folding field chair and leapt to his feet.
"Damn them!" he cursed. "They are mocking us! Issue orders!"
He strode up and down, shaking his fist.
"Have the cavalry form up for a charge immediately!"
"Your Highness, I urge you to reconsider."
"Damn it, West!"
The heir to the throne hurled his hat down on the muddy ground.
"You oppose me at every turn. Would your friend Colonel Glockter have hesitated with the enemy before him?"
West swallowed.
"Colonel Glockter was captured by the Gurkish and caused the deaths of every man under his command."
He bent slowly and picked up the hat, offered it respectfully up to the prince, wondering all the while whether he had just brought his career to an abrupt end. Ladislaw ground his teeth, breathing hard through his nose, snatched the hat out of West's hand.
"I have made my decision. Mine is the burden of command, and mine alone."
He turned back towards the valley.
"Sound the charge!"
West felt suddenly terribly tired. It seemed he scarcely had the strength to stand, as the confident bugle call rang out in the crisp air, as the horsemen struggled into their saddles, eased forward between the blocks of infantry, trotted down the gentle slope, lances up. They broke into a gallop as they crossed the valley floor, half obscured in a sea of mist, the thunder of their hoofbeats echoing round the valley. A few scattered arrows fell among them, glancing harmlessly from their heavy armor as they streamed forward. They began to lose momentum as they hit the upward slope, their lines breaking as they pushed on over the gorse and the broken ground, but the sight of all that weight of steel and horseflesh had its effect on the Northmen above. Their ragged line began to waver, then to break. They turned tail and fled, some of them tossing away their weapons as they disappeared over the brow of the hill.
"That's a damn recipe!" yelled Lord Smund. "Drive 'em, damn it! Drive 'em! Ride them down!"
laughed Prince Ladislaw, tearing off his hat again and waving it in the air. A scattering of cheers floated up from the levees in the valley over the distant hammering of hooves.
"Drive them," muttered West, clenching his fists. "Please."
The riders crested the ridge and gradually disappeared from view. Silence fell over the valley. A long, strange, unexpected silence. A few crows circled overhead, croaking their harsh calls to one another. West would have given anything for their view of the battlefield. The tension was almost unbearable. He strode back and forth while the long minutes stretched out, and still no sign.
"Taking their time, eh?"
Pike was standing right next to him, his daughter just behind. West winced and looked away. He still found it somehow painful to look at that burned face for long, especially coming on him sudden and unannounced.
"What are you two doing here?"
The convict shrugged his shoulders.
"There's plenty for a smith to do before a battle, even more after it. Not much while the fighting's happening, though."
He grinned, slabs of burned flesh folding up like leather on one side of his face.
"Thought I'd take a look at Union arms in action. Besides, what safer place could there be than the Prince's headquarters?"
"Don't mind us," muttered Cathill, a thin smile on her face. "We'll make sure to keep out of your way."
West frowned. If that was a reference to his being constantly in their way, he was in no mood to enjoy it. There was still no sign of the cavalry.
"Where the hell are they?" snapped Smund.
The prince took a break from chewing down his fingernails.
"Give 'em time, Lord Smund, give 'em time."
"Why doesn't this mist dry up?"
murmured West. There was enough sunlight breaking through the clouds now, but the mist only seemed to be thickening, creeping up the valley towards the archers.
"Damn mist, it'll work against us."
"That's them!"
yelled one of the prince's staff, shrill with excitement, fingers stretched out rigid towards the crest of the hill. West raised his eyeglass, breathless, scanned quickly across the green line. He saw the spear points, stiff and regular, rising slowly over the brow. He felt a surge of relief. Rarely had he been happier to be proved wrong.
"It's them!" yelled Smund, grinning broadly. "They're back! What did I tell you? They're..."
Helmets appeared beneath the spear points, and then mailed shoulders. West felt the relief seeping away, horror creeping up his throat. An organized body of armored men, their round shields painted with faces and animals and trees and 100 other patterns, no two alike. More men appeared over the crest of the hill to either side of them, more mailed figures. Bethod's carles. They halted just beyond the highest point of the hill. A scattering of men came forward from the even ranks, knelt in the short grass. Ladislaw lowered his eyeglass.
"Are those?"
"Flatbows," muttered West.
The first volley drifted up, gently almost, a shifting grey cloud of bolts, like a flock of well-trained birds. They were silent for a moment. Then the angry rattling of the bowstrings reached West's ears. The bolts began to drop towards the Union lines. They fell among the king's own, clattered down onto their heavy shields, their heavy armor. There were some cries, a few gaps appeared in their lines. The mood in the headquarters had turned in the space of a minute from brash confidence to mute surprise to stupefied dismay.
"They have flat bows?"
someone spluttered. West stared at the archers on the hill through his eyeglass, slowly cranking back their bowstrings, pulling bolts from their quivers, fitting them into position. The range had been well judged. Not only did they have flat bows, but they knew how to use them. West hurried over to Prince Ladislaw, who was gaping at a wounded man being carried head lolling from between the ranks of the king's own.
"Your Highness, we must advance and close the distance so that our archers can return fire or withdraw to higher ground."
Ladislaw only stared at him, giving no sign that he had heard, let alone understood. A second volley arced down into the infantry in front of them. This time it fell among the levies, a unit without shields or armor. Holes opened up all across the ragged formation, holes filled by the rising mist, and the whole battalion seemed to groan and waver. Some wounded man began to make a thin animal screeching and would not stop.
"Your Highness, do we advance or withdraw?"
Ladislaw
gaped over at Lord Smund, but for once the young nobleman was at a loss for words.
He looked even more stupefied than the prince, if that was possible. Ladislaus' lower lip trembled.
Colonel West, what is your opinion?
The temptation to remind the Crown Prince that his was the burden of command, and his alone, was almost overpowering, but West bit his tongue. Without some sense of purpose, this ragtag army might swiftly dissolve. Better to do the wrong thing than nothing at all. He turned to the nearest bugler.
"Sound the retreat!"
he roared. The bugles called the withdrawal, blaring, discordant. Hard to believe they were the same instruments that had so brazenly called the charge just a few short minutes before. The battalions began to edge slowly backwards. Another volley fell among the levies, and another. Their formations were beginning to come apart, men hurrying backwards to escape the murderous fire, stumbling over each other, ranks dissolving into mobs, the air full of shrieks and confusion. West could scarcely tell where the next set of flatbow bolts fell. The mist had risen so high. The Union battalions had become nothing more than wobbling spears and the odd insubstantial helmet above a grey cloud. Even here, high up among the baggage, the mist was curling round West's ankles. Up on the hill, the carles began to move. They thrust their weapons in the air and clashed them against their painted shields. They gave a great shout, but not the deep roar that West might have expected. Instead, a weird and chilling howl floated over the valley, a keening wail that cut through the rattling and scraping of metal and into the ears of those watching down below. A mindless, a furious, a primitive sound, a sound made by monsters, not by men. Prince Ladislaus and his staff gawped at one another and stuttered and stared as the carles began to tramp down the hill, rank upon rank of them, towards the thickening mist in the valley's bottom, where the Union troops were still blindly trying to pull back. West shouldered his way through the frozen officers to the bugler.
"Battle lines!"
The lad turned from staring at the advancing Northmen to staring at West, his bugle hanging from his nerveless fingers.
"Lines!"
roared a voice from behind.
"Form lines!"
It was Pike, bellowing loud enough to match any drill sergeant. The bugler snapped his instrument to his lips and blew lines for all he was worth. Answering calls echoed through the mist, risen up all around them now. Muffled bugles, muffled shouts.
"Halt and form up! Form lines now, lads! Prepare! Steady!"
A chorus of rattles and clanks came through the murk. Men moving in armour, spears being set, swords drawn, calls from man to man and from unit to unit. Above all, growing steadily louder, the unearthly howling of the Northmen as they began their charge, surging down from the high ground and into the valley. West felt a chill in his own blood, even with 100 strides of earth and a few thousand armed men between him and the enemy. He could well imagine the fear those in the front lines were feeling now, as the shapes of the carles began to rise out of the mist before them, screaming their war cries with their weapons held high. There was no sound that signified the moment of contact. The clattering grew louder and louder, the shouts and the howls were joined by high-pitched cries, low-pitched growls, shrieks of pain or rage mixed into the terrifying din with ever greater frequency. Nobody in the headquarters spoke. Every man, West among them, was peering into the murk, straining with every sense to get some hint of what might be happening just before them in the valley.
"There!"
someone shouted. A faint figure was moving through the gloom ahead. All eyes were fixed on it as it took shape before them. A young, breathless, mud-splattered and highly confused lieutenant.
"Where the hell is the headquarters?"
he shouted as he stumbled up the slope towards them.
"This is it."
The man gave West a flamboyant salute.
"Your Highness."
"I am Ladislaus," snapped the real prince.
The man turned, bewildered, began to salute once more.
"Speak your message, man."
"Of course, sir. Your Highness, Major Botzin has sent me to tell you that his battalion is heavily engaged and—
He was still gasping for breath.
He needs reinforcement.
Ladislas stared at the young man as though he had been speaking in a foreign language. He looked at West.
Who is Major Botzin?
Commander of the 1st Battalion of the Staraxa Levies, Your Highness, on our left wing.
Left wing? I see,
A semicircle of brightly dressed staff officers had congealed around the breathless lieutenant.
Tell the Major to hold! Shouted one of them.
Yes, said Ladislas. Tell your Major to hold and to drive back the enemy. Yes, indeed.
He was warming to his role now.
To drive them back and to fight to the last man. Tell Major Clodzin that help is on the way. Most definitely. On the way.
And the prince strode off manfully. The young lieutenant turned, peered into the murk.
Which way is my unit? He muttered.
More figures were already beginning to take form. Running figures, scrambling through the mud, panting for breath. Levies, West saw straight away, broken from the backs of crumbling units as soon as they had made contact with the enemy. As though there had ever been any chance that they would stand for long.
Cowardly dogs! Cursed Smund at their receding backs. Get back here!
He might as well have given orders to the mist. Everyone was running. Deserters, adjutants, messengers seeking for help, for direction, for reinforcement. The first wounded, too. Some were limping under their own power or using broken spears for crutches. Some were half carried by comrades. Pike started forward to help a pale fellow with a flatbow bolt sticking from his shoulder. Another casualty was dragged past on a stretcher, muttering to himself. His left arm was off just below the elbow, oozing blood through a tightly bound stretch of dirty cloth. Ladislas looked greasy pale.
I have a headache. I must sit down. What has become of my field chair?
West chewed at his lip. He had no inkling of what to do. Burr had sent him with Ladislas for his experience, but he was every bit as clueless as the prince. Every plan relied on being able actually to see the enemy, or at any rate, one's own positions. He stood there, frozen, as useless and frustrated as a blind man in a fistfight.
What is happening, dammit?
The prince's voice cut across the din, shrill and petulant.
Where did this damn mist come from? I demand to know what is happening. Colonel West, where is the colonel? What is going on out there?
If only he had been able to provide an answer. Men stumbled and darted and charged through the muddy headquarters, apparently at random. Faces loomed up from the mist and were gone. Faces full of fear, confusion, determination. Runners with garbled messages or garbled orders, soldiers with bloody wounds or no weapons. Disembodied voices floated on the cold air, speaking over one another, anxious, hurried, panicked, agonized.
Our regiment has made contact with the enemy and are falling back, or were falling back, I think.
My knee! Damn it, my knee!
His Highness the Prince, I have an urgent message from...
Send someone. Who is available? Who is available?
King's own are heavily engaged. They request permission to withdraw.
What happened to the cavalry? Where are the cavalry?
Devils, not men. The captain's dead and... We're falling back. Fighting hard on the right wing and in need of support. In desperate need of support.
Help me! Somebody, please!
And then counterattack. We're attacking all across the line. Quiet!
West could hear something in the grey gloom, the jingling of a harness. The mist was so dense now that he could see no more than 30 strides, but the sound of trotting hooves drawing closer was unmistakable. His hand closed round the hilt of his sword.
The cavalry! They've returned!
Lord Smund started eagerly forwards.
Wait!
Hissed West to no effect. His eyes strained into the grey. He saw the outlines of horsemen. Coming steadily through the gloom. The shapes of their armour, of their saddles, of their helmets, were those of the king's own, and yet there was something in the way they rode, slouching, loose.
West drew his sword. "Protect the prince," he muttered, taking a step towards Ladislaw.
"You there!" shouted Lord Smund at the foremost horseman. "Prepare your men for another—"
The rider's sword chopped into his skull with a hollow clicking sound. A spray of blood went up, black in the white mist, and the horsemen broke into a charge, screaming at the tops of their voices. Terrifying, eerie, inhuman sounds. Smund's limp body was flung out of the way by the leading horse, trampled under the flailing hooves of the one beside it. Northmen now, unmistakably, growing more horrifyingly distinct as they loomed up out of the murk. The foremost of them had a thick beard, long hair streaming out from beneath an ill-fitting Union helmet, yellow teeth bared, eyes of horse and rider, both wide with fury. His heavy sword flashed down and hacked one of the prince's guards between the shoulder blades as he dropped his spear and turned to run.
"Protect the prince!" screamed West.
Then it was chaos. Horses thundered past all around, riders yelled, hacked about them with swords and axes, men ran in all directions, slipped, fell, were cut down where they stood, were trampled where they lay. The heavy air was full of the wind of passing horsemen, flying mud, screams and panic and fear. West dived out of the way of flailing hooves, sprawled on his face in the muck, slashed uselessly at a passing horse, rolled and spun and gasped at the mist. He had no idea which way he was facing. Everything sounded the same, looked the same.
"Protect the prince!"
he shouted again, pointlessly, voice hoarse, drowned out in the din, spinning round and round.
"Over on the left!" someone shrieked. "Form a line!"
There were no lines. There was no left. West stumbled over a body, a hand clutched at his leg, and he slashed at it with his sword.
"Ah!"
He was on his face. His head hurt terribly. Where was he? Fencing practice, perhaps? Had Luthar knocked him down again? That boy was getting too good for him. He stretched for the grip of his sword, lying trampled in the mud. A hand slithered through grass, far away, fingers stretching. He could hear his own breathing, painfully loud, echoing in his thumping head. Everything was blurred, shifting, mist before his eyes, mist in his eyes. Too late. He could not reach his sword. His head was throbbing. There was mud in his mouth. He rolled over onto his back, slowly, breathing hard, up onto his elbows. He saw a man coming, a Northman by his shaggy outline. Of course, there was a battle. West watched him walk slowly forward. There was a dark line in his hand, a weapon. Sword, axe, mace, spear, what was the difference? The man took one more unhurried step, planted his boot on West's jacket, and shoved his limp body down into the mud. Neither of them said anything. No last words, no pithy phrases, no expressions of anger or remorse or of victory or defeat. The Northman raised his weapon. His body jolted. He lurched forward a step. He blinked and swayed. He half turned, slowly, stupidly. His head jolted again.
"Got something in?"
he said, lips fumbling with the words. He felt at the back of his head with his free hand.
"Where's my—"
He swiveled round, falling sideways, one leg in the air, and crashed onto his side in the muck. Somebody stood behind him. They came close, leaned over. A woman's face. She seemed familiar somehow.
"You alive?"
Like that, West's mind clicked back into place. He took a great coughing breath, rolled over, and grabbed hold of his sword. There were Northmen, Northmen behind their lines. He scrambled to his feet, clawed the blood out of his eyes. They had been tricked. His head was pounding, spinning. Bethod's cavalry, disguised, the prince's headquarters overrun. He jerked around, wild-eyed, boot-heels slipping in the mud, looking for enemies in the mist. But there was no one. Only him and Cathal. The sound of hooves had faded. The horsemen had passed, at least for now. He looked down at his steel. The blade was snapped off a few inches from the hilt. Worthless. He let it fall. Prized the Northman's dead fingers from his sword and grabbed hold of the hilt, his head thumping all the time. A heavy weapon with a thick notched blade,
but it would serve. He stared down at the corpse lying on its side, the man who had been about to kill him. The back of his skull was a caved-in mess of red splinters. Cathil had a smith's hammer in her hand. The head was sticky dark with blood and strands of matted hair.
You killed him.
She had saved his life. They both knew it, so there hardly seemed any point in saying it.
What do we do now?
Head for the front lines. That was what the dashing young officer always did in the stories Weston read as a boy. March for the sounds of battle. Rally a new unit from stragglers and lead them into the fray. Turn the tide of the fighting at the critical moment. Home in time for dinner and medals. Looking down at the wreckage and the broken corpses the horsemen had left behind, West almost laughed at the idea. It was suddenly too late for heroics, and he knew it. It had been too late for a long time. The fates of the men down in the valley had been set long ago, when Ladislaw chose to cross the river, when Burr set upon his plan, when the closed council decided to send the crown prince to win a reputation in the north, when the great noblemen of the Union sent beggars instead of soldiers to fight for their king. 100 different chances, from days and weeks and months before, all coming together here on this worthless stretch of mud. Chances which neither Burr nor Ladislaw nor West himself could have predicted or done anything to prevent. He could make no difference now. No one could. The day was lost.
"Protect the prince," he muttered.
"What?" West began to cast around on the ground, rooting through the scattered junk, rolling over bodies with his dirty hands. A messenger stared up at him, the side of his face split open, bloody pulp hanging out. West retched, covered his mouth, crawled on his hands and knees to the next corpse. One of the prince's staff, still with a look of faint surprise on his features. There was a ragged sword cut through the heavy gold braid of his uniform, reaching all the way down to his belly.
"What the hell are you doing?"
Pike's gruff voice.
"There's no time for this."
The convict had got an axe from somewhere, a heavy northern axe with blood on the edge. Not a good idea, most likely, for a criminal to have a weapon like that, but West had other worries.
"We must find Prince Ladislaw."
"Shit on him!" hissed Cathil. "Let's go!" West shook off her hand, stumbled to a heap of broken boxes, wiping more blood out of his eye. Somewhere here, somewhere near here, Ladislaw had been standing.
"No, I beg of you, no!"
squealed a voice. The heir to the throne of the Union was lying on his back in a hollow in the dirt, half obscured by the twisted corpse of one of his guards. His eyes were squeezed shut, arms crossed in front of his face, white uniform spotted with red blood, caked with black mud.
"There will be a ransom," he whimpered. "A ransom! More than you can imagine!"
One eye peered out from between his fingers. He grabbed at West's hand.
"Colonel West, is it you? You're alive!"
There was no time for pleasantries.
"Your Highness, we have to go."
"Go?"
mumbled Ladislaw, his face streaked with tear tracks.
"But surely you can't mean... have we won?"
West nearly bit his own tongue off. It was bizarre that the task should fall to him, but he had to save the prince. The vain and useless idiot might not deserve saving, but that changed nothing. It was for his own sake that West had to do it, not for Ladislaw's. It was his duty as a subject to save his future king, as a soldier to save his general, as one man to save another. It was all he could do now.
"You are the heir to the throne and cannot be spared."
West reached down and grabbed the prince by the elbow. Ladislaw fumbled with his belt.
"I lost my sword somewhere."
"We have no time!"
West hauled him up, fully prepared to carry him if he had to. He struck off through the mist, the two convicts close behind him.
"Are you sure this is the right way?"
growled Pike. I'm sure. He was anything but. The mist was thicker than ever. The pounding in his head and the blood trickling into his eye made it hard to concentrate. The sounds of fighting seemed to come from all around. Clashing and grating metal, groans and wails and yells of fury, all echoing in the mist and seeming one moment far away, the next terrifyingly near. Shapes loomed and moved and swam, vague and threatening outlines, shadows drifting just out of sight. A rider seemed to rise out of the mist, and West gasped and raised his sword. The cloud swirled. It was only a supply cart, laden down with barrels, mules standing still before it, driver sprawled out beside, with a broken spear sticking from his back.
"This way!"
hissed West, scuttling towards it, trying to keep close to the mud. Carts were good. Carts meant the baggage train, the supplies, the food, and the surgeons. Carts meant they were heading up out of the valley, away from the front lines at least, if there still were any such things. West thought about it for a moment. Carts were bad. Carts meant plunder. The Northmen would swarm to them like flies to honey, eager for booty. He pointed off into the mist, away from the empty wagons, the broken barrels, the upended boxes, and the others followed him, silent but for their squelching footfalls, their rasping breath. They slogged on over open ground, dirty clumps of wet grass gently rising. The others passed him one by one, and he waved them on. Their only chance was to keep moving, but every step was harder than the one before. Blood from the cut on his scalp was tickling away under his hair, down the side of his face. The pain in his head was growing worse, not better. He felt weak, sick, horribly dizzy. He clung to the grip of the heavy sword as though it was keeping him up, bent over double, struggling to stay on his feet.
"You all right?"
asked Cathill.
"Keep moving,"
he managed to grunt at her. He could hear hooves, or thought that he could. Fear kept him going, and fear alone. He could see the others ahead of him, laboring forwards. Prince Ladislaw well in front, Pike next, Cathill just ahead, looking back over her shoulder. There was a group of trees. He could see them through the thinning mist. He fixed on their ghostly shapes and made for them, his breath rasping in his throat as he floundered up the slope. He heard Cathill's voice.
"No!"
He turned, horror creeping up his throat. He saw the outline of a rider not far behind them.
"Make for the trees!"
he gasped. She didn't move, so he grabbed her arm and shoved her forwards, fell on his face in the mud as he did it. He rolled over, floundered up, began to stumble away from her, away from the trees, away from safety, sideways across the slope. He watched the Northman take shape as he rode up out of the mist. He had seen West now, was trotting up towards him, his spear lowered. West carried on creeping sideways, legs burning, lungs burning, using his last grains of strength to lead the rider away. Ladislaw was already in the trees. Pike was just sliding into the bushes. Cathill took one last look over her shoulder and followed him. West could go no further. He stopped, crouching on the hillside, too tired even to stand, let alone fight, and watched the Northman come on. The sun had broken through the clouds, was glinting on the blade of his spear. West had no idea what he would do when he arrived, apart from die. Then the horseman reared up in his saddle, scrabbled at his side. There were feathers there, grey feathers, blowing in the wind. He let go a short scream. His scream stopped, and he stared at West. There was an arrowhead sticking out of his neck. He dropped his spear and tumbled slowly backwards out of his saddle. His horse trotted past, curved away up the slope, slowed to a walk, and stopped. West crouched against the wet ground for a moment, unable to understand how he had escaped death. He tottered towards the trees, each stride a vast undertaking, all his joints floppy as a puppet's. He felt his knees give way, and he crashed down into the brush. There were strong fingers plucking at the wound on his scalp, words muttered in Northern.
"Ah!"
yelped West, prising his eyes open a crack.
Stop whining.
The dog man was staring down at him.
Just a scrape. You got off light. Came right to me, but you're lucky still. I've been known to miss.
Lucky,
muttered West. He turned over in the wet bracken and stared across the valley between the tree trunks. The mist was finally starting to clear, slowly revealing a trail of broken carts, of broken gear, of broken bodies. All the ugly detritus of a terrible defeat, or a terrible victory, if you stood with Bethod. A few hundred strides away, he watched a man running desperately towards another stand of trees. A cook, maybe, by his clothes. A horseman followed him, spear couched in his arm. He missed at the first pass, caught him on the way back, and knocked him to the ground. West should have felt horror as he watched the rider trot up and stab the helpless runner with his spear, but he only felt a guilty gladness. Glad that it wasn't him. There were other figures, other horsemen, moving on the slopes of the valley. Other bloody little dramas, but West could watch no more. He turned away, slid back down into the welcoming safety of the bushes. The dogman was chuckling softly to himself.
Three trees'll shit when he sees what I've caught me.
He pointed at the strange, exhausted, mud-spattered group one by one.
Half-dead Colonel West, girl with a bloody hammer, man with a face like the back end of a cookpot, and this one here, lest I'm deceived, is the boy who had charge of this fucking disaster. By the dead, but fate plays some tricks.
He shook his head slowly, grinning down at West as he lay on his back, gasping like a landed fish.
Three trees is gonna shit.
Chapter 24. One for dinner. To Archlector Salt, head of His Majesty's Inquisition. Your Eminence, I have happy news. The conspiracy is unmasked and torn up by the roots. Corsten Dan Worms, the son of the Lord Governor, and Carlot Dan Ida, the Magister of the Guild of Spices, were the principals. They will be questioned, and then punished in such a manner that our people will understand the price of treason. It would appear that De Voost fell victim to a Gurkish agent, long hidden within the city. The assassin is still at large, but with the plotters in our power, it cannot be long before we catch him. I have had Lord Governor Worms placed under close arrest. The treason of the son renders the father unreliable, and he has been a hindrance in the administration of the city in any case. I will send him back to you by the next ship, so that you and your colleagues on the closed council may decide his fate. Along with him will come one Inquisitor Harker, responsible for the deaths of two prisoners who might otherwise have rendered us valuable information. I have questioned him, and am fully satisfied he had no part in any plot, but he is nonetheless guilty of incompetence tantamount to treason. I leave his punishment in your hands. The Gurkish assault came at first light. Picked troops rushed forwards with ready-made bridges and tall ladders, straight across open ground, and were met with a murderous volley from 500 flatbows ranged all along our walls. It was a brave effort, but a rash one, and was repulsed with much slaughter on their side. Only two bold parties made it to our man-made channel, where bridge, ladder, and men were quickly swept away by a fierce current that flows from the sea into the bay at certain times of day, a happy and unforeseen chance of nature. Gurkish corpses now litter the empty ground between our channel and their lines, and I have ordered our men to fire upon anyone who attempts to offer succor to the wounded. The groans of the dying and the sight of Gurkish bodies rotting in the sun cannot but cause a useful weakening of their morale. Though the first taste of victory has come to us, in truth this attack was little more than a first feeling out of our defences. The Gurkish commander but dips his toe in the water to test the temperature. His next attack, I do not doubt, will be on a different scale altogether. three mighty catapults assembled within 400 strides of our walls and more than capable of hurling huge stones clean into the lower city, yet stand silent. Perhaps they hope to take Dagoska intact, but if our resistance holds, this hesitation cannot long continue. They certainly do not want for men. More Gurkish soldiers pour onto the peninsula every day. The standards of 8 legions are now plainly visible above the throng, and we have spotted detachments of savages from every corner of the Cantic continent. A mighty host, perhaps 50,000 strong or more, is ranged against us. The Gurkish emperor, Uthman Uldosht, bends all his power against our walls, but we will hold firm. You will hear from me soon. Until then, I serve and obey. San Dan Glockta, Superior of Dagoska. Magister Carlot Dan Ida, head of the Guild of Spicers, sat in her chair, hands in her lap, and did her best to maintain her dignity. Her skin was pale and oily, there were dark rings under her eyes. Her white garments were stained with the dirt of the cells, her hair had lost its sheen and hung lank and matted across her face. She looked older without her powder and her jewels, but she still seemed beautiful. More than ever, in a way, the beauty of the candle flame that has almost burned out.
"You look tired," she said.
Glockta raised his brows.
"It has been a trying few days. First, there was the questioning of your accomplice, Worms. Then the small matter of an assault by the Gurkish army camped outside our walls. You appear somewhat fatigued yourself."
"The floor of my tiny cell is not that comfortable, and then I have my own worries."
She looked up at Severard and Vitari, leaning against the walls on either side of her, arms folded, masked and implacable.
"Am I going to die in this room?"
"Undoubtedly."
"That remains to be seen. Worms has already told us most of what we need to know. You came to him, you offered him money to forge his father's signature on certain documents, to give orders in his father's name to certain guardsmen, to participate, in short, in the betrayal of the city of Dagoska to the enemies of the Union. He has named everyone involved in your scheme. He has signed his confession. His head, in case you were wondering, is decorating the gate beside that of your friend Islik, the Emperor's ambassador."
"Both together on the gate," sang Severard.
"There are only 3 things he was not able to give me. Your reasons, your signature, and the identity of the Gurkish spy who killed Superior Davoust. I will have those 3 from you now."
Magister Ida carefully cleared her throat, carefully smoothed the front of her long gown, sat up as proudly as she could.
"I do not believe that you will torture me. You are not Davoust. You have a conscience."
The corner of Glockta's mouth twitched slightly.
"A brave effort. I do applaud you. But how wrong you are."
"I have a conscience, but it's a feeble, withered shred of a thing. It couldn't protect you or anyone else from a stiff breeze."
Glockta sighed long and hard. The room was too hot, too bright. His eyes were sore and twitchy, and he rubbed at them slowly as he spoke.
"You could not even guess at the things that I have done. Awful, evil, obscene. The telling of them alone could make you puke."
He shrugged. "They nag at me from time to time, but I tell myself I had good reasons. The years pass, the unimaginable becomes everyday. The hideous becomes tedious, the unbearable becomes routine. I push it all into the dark corners of my mind, and it's incredible. The room,
back there. Amazing what one can live with.
Glockter glanced up at Severard's eyes and Vitari's, glittering hard and pitiless.
But even supposing you were right, can you seriously